Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Under the Trestle, the 1980 disappearance of Gina Renee Hall, and Virginia's first no-body murder trial. By Ron Peterson, Jr. Narrated by Kyle Tate. Introduction. The scuba diver moved slowly along the bottom of the lake, 80 feet below the surface, searching for a dead human body. It was a sunny day at the surface, but 80 feet down, he could not see his hand in front of his face. This was a black water dive. He relied on his fingers' sense of touch, feeling the silty lake bottom as he inched along. He was performing what search and rescue divers call a fingertip search body recovery operation, hoping to literally run into the body. The diver had been underwater for 20 minutes, covering 50 feet of the lake bottom, moving along a straight line. 11 other search divers, arranged on both sides of him at even intervals, moved along a parallel grid in the same direction. So far, their collective hands and fingertips had encountered nothing but the silt and sediment along the bottom, along with the occasional remnants of an old tree stump. He was startled when his right hand suddenly came in contact with an object. Could this be the body? He thought to himself. His first tactile impression was that the object had the same general degree of firmness as a human body. In the blind darkness, he explored the object inch by inch, using all 10 of his fingertips. Yes, although he could not feel the texture through his gloves, the degree of firmness was consistent with that of a human body. And the object seemed to be resting on the bottom, not sunken into the lake bed like a tree stump. It rose up about 10 inches above the bottom, consistent with the profile of a body. His pulse rate quickened as he felt its curvature, again consistent with a body. As he took another minute to examine the object with his fingers in the pitch blackness, he became positive. It was not a human body. It was a discarded automobile tire that someone had tossed into the lake years ago. Clater Lake, a freshwater paradise in the majestic mountains of southwest Virginia, is an outdoorsman's dream. The huge 4,000-acre lake features miles of wooded shoreline, dotted with hundreds of lake cottages. Anglers fish the coves for bass. Sailboats enjoy the steady winds. Powerboats pull water skiers. And young swimmers do cannonballs off docks into the cool mountain water. Located 50 miles from Roanoke and 3 miles from Radford, the lake was formed in 1939 when the Appalachian Power Company constructed a massive dam, impounding the New River. The result was the 21-mile-long lake, half a mile across at its widest point, following the winding contour of what was previously a river valley. The project provided hydroelectric power for the region, while also forming the abundant recreational mecca that folks in this corner of Virginia have enjoyed for generations. But tragically, on this particular Saturday, July 12, 1980, Clater Lake was the scene of one of the largest body searches in Virginia history. Law enforcement had called in every resource imaginable to hunt for the remains of 18-year-old Gina Renee Hall. 2 weeks previously, the petite Radford University freshman visited a nightclub near Virginia Tech to go dancing on a Saturday night. She left the club with a man shortly after midnight and had not been seen again. Starting at daybreak, over 100 law enforcement officers from 3 states combed the surrounding water and banks of the lake in their search for Gina, who had now been missing for 14 days. The 12 scuba divers meticulously searched the underwater lake bed. Because the deepest section was 125 feet, a mobile decompression chamber was on site in the event a diver suffered the bends. In other sections of the huge lake, where the bottom was free of underwater obstructions like tree stumps, rescue squad volunteers rowed slowly in a small John boat. In a process known morbidly as dragging the lake, they were trying to hook a body. While one of the volunteers navigated, another was at the back of a boat, holding onto a thick 50-foot-long rope, as if it were a fishing line. On the other end of the rope, about 30 feet down at the lake bottom, was a 20-pound iron grappling hook with two large, sharp prongs, looking like a gargantuan fishing hook. The trick for the man working the drag was to keep the rope taut and the grappling hook sliding just at or inches above the lake bottom. Easy to say, but hard to do. It was a grueling task, one that made your arms ache after just 15 minutes. And this volunteer had been at it for 4 hours. 4 search and rescue dogs trained in cadaver scent detection had been brought in from Northern Virginia. Each of them had undergone years of training, much of which involved search-and-find exercises with rotten pig flesh. They had the amazing ability to pick up the faint scent of a decomposing corpse's gases rising up to the water's surface. These dogs had previously found dozens of bodies. One of the dogs, a bloodhound, Bambi, rode leaning precariously over the bow of the boat, hanging her nose so close to the water that her handler worried she might fall overboard. As she sniffed the water's surface, her handler closely observed her behavior, looking for the telltale sign of an alert or change in demeanor of his dog, like barking at the water, indicating she had caught the scent of a dead body. A mysterious RV was parked at the lake's edge, with signage reading, "Nationwide Tracking Search and Rescue." Police were closed-mouthed about the identity of the owner. No one realized it, but in 6 months, the German Shepherd and his handler residing in the camper would become star witnesses in a murder trial unlike any in Virginia history. A $10,000 reward for information leading to Gina Hall's remains was publicized. So in nearby areas adjacent to the lake, volunteers of a more mercenary nature conducted impromptu searches of surrounding forests and farmland. Many were high school kids who had gathered a group of their pals. As they searched, the teenagers talked enthusiastically of what they would do with the reward money if they found the body. Pulaski County, which surrounds Clater Lake, is known for having many caves in the hollows and valleys of the rugged mountain terrain. Since there were several caves within walking distance of the lake, a group of amateur cavers from nearby Giles County had been invited to join the search. The spelunkers were currently on the far side of the lake, negotiating through a substantial cave, whose beach ball-sized mouth was obscured by brush on one of the steep lake banks. You had to know the cave was there to find the entrance. They were close enough to the lake that they could hear the boats from within the cavern's darkness. The spelunkers shined their bulky carbide lights, predecessors to the LED lights now used, throughout the nooks and crannies inside. The search organizers had instructed them to depend most on their sense of smell, as they would most definitely smell a 2-week-old corpse way before they would see it. As the search continued, several interested parties watched the day's events unfold from a distance. One of them was the man in charge of the Gina Hall case. He was the determined young Commonwealth attorney, 28-year-old Everett Shockley, the chief law enforcement officer of Pulaski County. Just 7 months earlier, fresh out of the College of William and Mary's Law School, he had been elected to his position, defeating a popular 16-year incumbent by only 89 votes. Shockley ran a tough-on-crime campaign, promising voters a lower crime rate, higher conviction rate, and stiffer sentences for offenders. He sincerely wanted to keep that promise to the good citizens of his county. The pressure to find Gina's body and hold her killer accountable was resting squarely on his shoulders. It was a heavy load. The lead investigator, Virginia State Police Officer Clarence Austin Hall, no relation to Gina Hall, stood beside Shockley, a styrofoam cup of coffee in his hand. Austin Hall needed the caffeine because he had slept very little over the past 2 weeks, devoting both day and night to the case. Trooper Hall's friendly demeanor endeared him to everyone, especially his wife and 2 young kids, who had not seen him for 2 days. A former Virginia Tech football player, Stephen Madison Epperly, was the prime suspect in Gina's disappearance and murder. He had never been convicted of a crime, but had a violent past, along with two rape acquittals on his resume. Epperly had been interrogated repeatedly in this case, but vigorously denied the accusation of murder. A mountain of circumstantial evidence pointed directly at him alone. Every law enforcement officer involved was confident Epperly was the killer, yet he had not been arrested. How could they charge and convict him of murder with no corpse? There was no precedent for a no-body murder conviction in Virginia legal history. It had never been done. When Commonwealth Attorney Shockley mentioned to his peers the possibility of pressing charges against Epperly with no body, they strongly advised him not to do so. To seek a murder conviction without a body and have the suspect be found not guilty would be career suicide. The best view of the lake for an interested onlooker would have been from the luxurious three-level A-frame cabin at 4955 Weaver Road, perched on a hill with a million-dollar view of Clater Lake. Inside, the house's owners, Ronald and Betty Davis, were emotional wrecks, with feelings running the gamut from sorrow to regret to anger. They felt deep sorrow for the family of Gina Hall, the missing young RU student who, by every account, was a daughter who would make any parent proud. The beautiful, soft-spoken girl was described by friends as one of the most thoughtful and sincere people they had ever met. She once had a promising future, but had perplexingly gone missing, and was now believed dead. 2 weeks earlier, the Davises had driven to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, for a week of vacation. They felt haunting regret for leaving the lake house, their primary residence, in the care of Betty's 27-year-old son, Ronald Davis's stepson, Bill Skipper King, also a former Virginia Tech Hokies football player. On his first night of house sitting, Bill King and his longtime buddy Epperly had gone out for an evening on the town, to the lounge of the Blacksburg Marriott. Around midnight, Epperly borrowed the key to the lake house from King, left the nightclub with Gina Hall, and brought her back to the secluded cabin. Epperly was the last known person to see her alive. The anger the Davises felt was focused squarely on Epperly, who police believed had turned their beloved lake house into a bloody homicide scene. Ronald and Betty had always been wary of Steve Epperly, one of their son's best friends since the pair were 8 years old. A ruggedly handsome guy from a working-class family, his aggressive nature had led to many incidents of violence in the past, which the townspeople discussed in hushed tones. The Davises returned from their Myrtle Beach vacation and were dumbfounded to learn that police investigators had discovered blood spattered throughout four rooms of their home, even on Mr. Davis's golf shoes and their refrigerator door. On the den floor carpeting was the remnant of a large bloodstain the size of a watermelon. Meanwhile, Gina's father, John Hall, was living a parent's worst nightmare, back at his daughter's apartment in Radford. He had been out with the searchers at dawn, but now stared at the telephone on the wall, desperately awaiting any kind of update. He had been going through the worst hell imaginable, with a terrible feeling in his stomach that refused to go away. The police had developed a close relationship with Mr. Hall, rare in a line of work where maintaining professional detachment with victims' families is essential. Investigators candidly shared evidence showing that his daughter, the light of his life, was dead. He could not sleep, his mind painstakingly alternating between two things, a faint glimmer of hope that Gina was somehow still alive, and a desperate realization that she was deceased and that her body needed to be found, so the family could give her the good Christian burial that she deserved. For the past 2 weeks, Mr. Hall had taken up temporary residence in the apartment near the Radford University campus, where Gina lived with her older sister, Delana. It enabled him to be in closer proximity to local law enforcement as well as the many dozens of friends and hundreds of volunteers who were canvassing the area day after day. Desperate for help, Mr. Hall had even enlisted the help of a nationally known psychic who had arrived in Radford a week earlier and provided his insight. Police are always skeptical of psychics, but this one had found bodies before in several well-documented cases. The psychic's information in this case was credible enough that police continued to take it into account as they theorized where Gina Hall's body might be. By early afternoon, the search of the area in and immediately around Clater Lake had concluded, with no results. It would now move on to the next quadrant of the hunt, a meandering 3-mile stretch of the New River downstream from the lake, between the dam and the town of Radford. Despite its name, geologists tell us the New River is actually the second oldest river in the world, having carved a deep valley through mountains for millions of years. It is a spectacular river, with many sharp turns and oxbows through high mountain peaks. Beginning high in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, it winds into Virginia with frequent hairpin curves through the tall mountains. The river widens, becoming a reservoir along the 21-mile segment where it is impounded to form Clater Lake. Then, for the next 3 miles, it becomes more tranquil as it flows gently past the town of Radford, where college students enjoy kayaking and inner tubing on serene stretches. As it enters West Virginia, the New River becomes increasingly wild with breathtaking rapids that make for some of the best whitewater rafting in the East. It then combines with the Gauley River to form the Ohio River, which in turn is a tributary of the mighty Mississippi. Thus, the New River holds the distinction of being the only Virginia River to flow into the Gulf of Mexico and not the Atlantic Ocean. Native American Indians centuries earlier dubbed the New River the River of Death because of the many drownings that occur when a person standing in shallow water is knocked off their feet by the deceptively fast current. As they struggle to stay afloat in the increasingly swift water, oftentimes the person's arm, leg, or entire body gets wedged between or under boulders. The ruthless force of the rapids then holds the victim underwater, and they drown. Some of the investigators hunting for Gina envisioned this sort of possible entrapment scenario, where her body had potentially been dumped in the river by the perpetrator and eventually became trapped underwater below an undercut boulder and then held submerged in place by the steady current. So, at 2 o'clock p.m., Appalachian Power Company raised the gates on the gigantic dam at Clater Lake, an 1,100-foot-long and 125-foot-high concrete monstrosity. This halted the flow of water downriver. The water level of the New River began to drop to better accommodate search efforts. The 4 boats carrying the cadaver-sniffing canines were promptly launched just below the dam. They began their role in the search, traveling down the 3-mile stretch of river with military precision, each boat 25 yards apart. Additional search dogs worked each bank of the river, while other personnel walked behind them, searching the heavy brush along the banks. After the river had been searched for 3 hours at the low tide level, the gates were opened at the dam, releasing a high volume of water to rush downstream toward the town of Radford. The swift water and waves splashed the many rocks and boulders with a vigorous current. If the body was entrapped under boulders or between rocks, this would hopefully wash it out, resulting in what search and rescue types called a blowout. As the river filled with rapids, a state police helicopter flew slowly and deliberately above, so close to the river that casual observers worried it would crash. Behind the pilot, 2 officers sat side saddle, one on each side of the craft, looking intently out the open doors of the copter, scanning the river for the body. But as darkness set in at the end of the day, the members of the giant search party, who were optimistic at dawn, were now exhausted. Many were dejected, painfully so. After a 16-hour day of meticulous searching, they came to a bitter realization. This would not be the day they found Gina Renee Hall. Warily, they faced the fact that with each passing day, the odds of finding Gina's remains was growing smaller. Rivertown. The summer of 1980, absent this tragedy, would have been a picture-perfect time to be in the quaint city of Radford, nestled along a horseshoe bend on the New River in the mountains of southwest Virginia. It was known as a college town, but as the 11,000 permanent residents would quickly tell you, it was also a great place to settle down and raise a family, which proud residents had been doing for generations. Along with nearby towns Blacksburg and Christiansburg, as well as Pulaski and Montgomery counties, it formed a very livable region known as the New River Valley. Radford was established over a century earlier when the Virginia and Tennessee Railroad came to town in 1854. A predecessor of Norfolk Southern, the V&T built a new railroad depot in the middle of downtown, serving as a catalyst for Radford's early growth. By the late 1800s, Radford was a booming railroad town and trade center due to its strategic location between Lynchburg to the east and Bristol at the far western corner of the state. Most of Radford's early development was along the downtown Main Street and the quaint residential neighborhood comprising the central part of town. The architectural centerpiece was Grove Avenue, a few blocks from downtown, lined with beautiful Victorian homes, four squares, and bungalows. The turn of the century continued to bring prosperity, as large factories set up shop on the west side of town, providing a substantial base of steady jobs. Soon to follow was development of several residential neighborhoods, consisting mostly of small single-family dwellings, also on the west side of town. They were well-built, affordable houses, which made homeownership a reality for blue-collar families. In 1940, with World War II in full swing, the U.S. military needed a place to manufacture gunpowder and ammunition. After evaluating several potential sites around the country, a location on the edge of Radford's city limits was chosen, due to the area's ample workforce. The Radford Army Ammunition Plant was built and ramped up to employ 20,000 people during World War II. It remains the New River Valley's largest employer to this day. After the war, the Radford Army Ammunition Plant, or RAAP, found its niche manufacturing the nitroglycerin used to propel the Army's artillery shells and rockets. Dealing with the highly explosive nitro was very dangerous. Over a 40-year span, 39 lives were lost at the plant in 25 separate accidents. Employees were literally blown to smithereens in explosions from the volatile chemical compounds. Despite the hazards, it was steady work and better than average pay, so the jobs were highly coveted. The area to the east of downtown Radford, previously Rolling Woods, received a big boost in 1913 when the state located a new women's college in East Radford to educate teachers. The college gradually expanded its curriculum and in the mid-1940s became the women's division of Virginia Tech. Radford College declared its independence from VT in the mid-1960s, went co-ed in 1972, and achieved university status in 1979. The college's growth pumped a refreshing supply of young students and culturally diverse faculty into the town's demographics. Radford University is now a thriving 9,000-student research university with a national reputation. By 1980, the town of Radford had evolved into a thriving city that kept its small-town vibe. With a bustling population of 11,000, there was an interesting diversity between the established residents of the working-class west side of town and the young college crowd on the east side. No one could foresee that a horrible event would occur that summer when individuals from the two contrasting sides of town met. Gina Hall. Gina Renee Hall, 18. Was voted most popular for Coburn High School's graduating class of 1979. She had a lot going for her, as the townsfolk loved to say. Her positive energy and enthusiastic smile brightened the day of everyone she came in contact with. Her hometown, Coburn, is a tiny mountain hamlet in the far western corner of Virginia. Located in Wise County, Coburn is the heart of coal country, not far from the Virginia border with Kentucky and Tennessee. With a population of around 2,000, Coburn is the kind of place where no one is a stranger, and people do not lock their doors. Gina was such a respectful, sweet girl growing up, her older sister Delana recalls. When I say she never got in trouble, I mean she never got in trouble. Ever. She was every parent's dream child. Growing up, Gina was active in a dizzying array of activities. Girls' sports were not as popular or widespread in the 70s, but Gina, ahead of her time, played tennis, golf, and gymnastics at the high school level. In tennis, she advanced to the state championship her senior year at Coburn High. She loved the social aspect of the game, and teammates recall she played her best in doubles matches, where everyone wanted her as a partner, due to Gina's sense of teamwork. Besides school activities, Gina taught children gymnastics and tap dancing. The Hall family was active at Coburn United Methodist Church, where she led a Bible study group and taught Sunday school classes. Making Gina's zest for life even more touching was that she had endured a terrible accident as a child. When Gina was 2 years old, she brushed against a burner on a gas stove in her house, which ignited her cotton pajamas into flames. The accident resulted in severe third-degree burns over approximately 90% of the right side of her body, including her chest, abdomen, upper right arm, and thigh. She fought for her life in the weeks and months that followed. Her condition was so grave that doctors later stated that 75% of young patients in a case like hers would have died from shock or sepsis. Nurses at Charlottesville's University of Virginia Medical Center burn unit were inspired by Gina's fighting spirit. When Gina finally came home from the hospital, everyone in Coburn was there to support her. Everybody in town provided so much love and support for Gina as she recovered from her burns, Delana remembers. Gina was truly Coburn's girl. People seemed to really empathize with what she had been through and admired how hard she fought to recover. She had such a wonderful little attitude. She never felt sorry for herself. Gina was an inspiration for so many people. In the years that followed, throughout her childhood, her father took her on long trips to see burn specialists at the UVA Medical Center, along with consultations at Duke University. This was the mid-1960s, so the procedure of skin grafting was in its infancy. Gina had over a dozen surgeries. Some involved excision of the wounds, a surgical procedure in which incisions were made through areas of the deep burns to remove the scarred tissue. As Gina's body grew, the lack of elasticity in these areas made it necessary for her to endure more of the excruciating surgeries. She was still undergoing the procedures as a teenager. As a result, Gina had terrible scarring on her right arm, from her shoulder down to her elbow, and her right leg, from her upper thigh down to her knee. The worst scars were along her torso, leaving her disfigured from above her right breast to below her waistline. The surgical excisions had also left an indentation over an inch deep, running along the right side of her chest down to her abdomen. Gina managed to keep the areas concealed by dressing conservatively. She typically wore long sleeves and long pants, with tights underneath, even in the summer. Because she effectively covered the scars with her clothing, Gina had the physical appearance of a beautiful girl, with a normal, shapely body. Understandably, Gina was very self-conscious about her body and avoided serious romantic relationships. According to her sister Delana, Gina was extremely concerned about how her scars would affect a man's feelings for her. She could not have handled the emotional stress of a physical relationship with somebody and never put herself in that situation, Delana said. As a result, she dated only on occasion, her high school prom being one instance. Most of her dates were just friends, typically boys with whom she played tennis. Gina's mother blamed herself for Gina's burns, experiencing tremendous guilt and psychological problems. She became estranged from the family, leaving Mr. Hall to raise the children alone. When Gina was six, her father married his second wife, Joan. Gina's relationship with Joan was close, the pair enjoying a strong bond.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?